From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. A father is a man who fails every day, writes Michael Chabon in his collection of personal essays, Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. It's now out in paperback. We talk with Michael Chabon. Also, the letters that psychologist Dan Gottlieb wrote to his autistic grandson were collected in the popular book Letters to Sam. Gottlieb, who became a paraplegic in a car accident over 20 years ago, was writing to his grandson about what it is to be different. He now has a new follow-up book. We'll hear from Dan Gottlieb. And film critic David Edelstein reviews two new documentaries, The Lottery, about school choice in Harlem, and Restrepo, journalist Sebastian Younger's film following a group of soldiers in Afghanistan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Michael Chabon is best known for his novels The Yiddish Policeman's Union, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which won a Pulitzer Prize, Wonder Boys, and The Mysteries of Pittsburgh. He's also written personal essays, and some of them are collected in his latest book, which is now out in paperback. It's called Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. Chabon is married to the novelist Ayelet Waldman, who wrote a memoir earlier this year about her life as a mother. Chabon and Waldman have four children, two boys and two girls. Terry spoke with Michael Chabon last year when Manhood for Amateurs was first published.
Michael Chabon, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to read the opening of one of the chapters from your new book, Manhood for Amateurs.
Great, I'd love to. This is William and I. The handy thing about being a father is that the historic standard is so pitifully low. One day a few years back, I took my youngest son to the market around the corner from our house in Berkeley, California, a town where, in my estimation, fathers generally do a passable job, with some fathers having been known to go a little overboard. I was holding my 20-month-old in one arm and unloading the shopping cart onto the checkout counter with the other. I don't remember what I was thinking about at the time, but it is as likely to have been the original 1979 jingle for Honey Nut Cheerios, or nothing at all, as it was the needs, demands, or ineffable wonder of my son. I wasn't quite sure why the woman in line behind us, when I became aware of her, kept beaming so fondly in our direction. She had on rainbow leggings, and I thought she might be a little bit crazy and therefore fond of everyone. "You are such a good dad," she said finally. "I can tell."
What struck you as odd or baffling about the praise you were getting for being such a good dad in the supermarket?
Well, because I wasn't doing anything. I mean, I was literally doing nothing. But, you know, and then in fact, as I go on to say in the piece, I think if you step back and looked at me critically, I was probably making a few errors in parenting at that point. Like my kid was chewing on one of the twist ties for the fruit for the produce bags, and you know his face was dirty and his hair was a mess. I mean, objectively speaking, even by my own standards, I was doing kind of a lousy job at that moment. Certainly wasn't doing a good job, and yet there I was being given this gift of praise and so much credit, and it was clearly, and as often the case anyway, it's just because the mere fact somehow that I'm just there, you know, holding on to my kid, that's like enough. That's all it takes to qualify sometimes.
You and your wife are both writers, and I'm always so interested when writers are couples, in part because there's an element of writing that includes a certain amount of betrayal, because whether you're writing a memoir or fiction, there's something you're going to be revealing about people you're close to. You know, whether it's transformed through fiction or whether it's, you know, straightforward through personal essay or memoir. And when you're both in that position, it's something that I assume you really understand about what each other needs to do. I don't know if it makes it any easier, though. And most of your writing has been fiction. Most of your wife's writing has been fiction, although mm-hmm. her previous book was personal essays, as is yours. And so I wonder what it's like for you when she writes really personal things that include things like how you decided to terminate a pregnancy after mm-hmm. amniocentesis, or mm-hmm. that she had considered suicide for a moment. And these are so personal things that, you know, Is it hard for you to read that? Is it hard? Are there reverberations in your life that are unexpected from things like that?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, it's not like you know, a scene in a movie where, like, you know, the guy Spencer Tracy like picks up his morning newspaper and there's this like thing his wife has written about them, and you know, and like, what? you know, I mean, we share work with each other as it's coming out of the printer, you know. So if she's written a piece or I've written a piece that is some way personal, or in which one of us says something about the other, you know, we're each other's first reader. So, you know, let's use her as an example. So say she's writing something, you know, the piece about the genetic termination, you know, I mean, she was sharing with, first of all, she was sharing it with me as she was writing it, and she I knew she was going to write it, and then she wrote it, and I read it, and you know, at that point, for her or for me, I think each of us implicitly feels that he or she has the right to, you know, to say, I'm not comfortable with that. In practice, it doesn't really happen that often. I think, you know, that's where we do have a recognition, a fundamental recognition that that's where writing comes from, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. So I try to be philosophical about it. And, you know, there are unforeseen consequences, and there are things, you know, she wrote that's now kind of infamous piece that was published in the New York Times, and it had initially just been written for this little anthology. So
I'm going to stop you and quote it so everybody knows what you're talking about. She said that she loved her husband more than her children, and then she said, if I were to lose one of my children, God forbid, even if I lost all my children, God forbid, I would still have my husband. But my imagination simply fails when I try to picture a future beyond my husband's death. So that was like the real controversial thing that she wrote.
Yes, right. And, you know, so from my point of view, reading that piece, first of all, that's just Ayelet. That's what she says. She's been saying that for years. You know, by the time she got around to writing that down, I had been living with that kind of expression of her feeling for a long time. It just really kind of blew over me without my even paying that much attention.
Whereas a lot of readers thought, like, what kind of mother is she?
Exactly.
She loves her husband more than her children. How can any mother say that? So that's what,
right,
what made it so controversial. So anyways,
right,
go ahead.
I didn't even, you know, I just like, yep, that's how you feel, honey. I know that. Thank you. I'm, you know, it's sweet that you're so devoted to me, and I love you too. I mean, it was just sort of you know, to me, it was what caught my attention more in that piece was that she was writing about sex and not only, you know, our sex life. Not that she was really going into detail, but she was at least acknowledging the fact that we do have a sex life. And then, you know, talking about her, you know, women she knows and their sex lives. I mean, to me, that was what I thought the piece was about, and that's where I thought the sort of buzz in it might come from. But then it was just going to be in this little anthology, and nobody was going to read it. And by circuitous means, it ended up being in the New York Times. And you know, that was one of the moments, maybe the single greatest moment, where suddenly, you know, I had not really anticipated what the reaction would be or what the response would be or how that might play out. So I was getting, you know, emails from people saying, hey, sex god. And, you know, it was not, you know, I wasn't ready. I had not been prepared in that sense, even though I knew, as I said, I already knew what was in it and had approved it.
So,
tacitly.
Did that make you think twice about revealing personal things in your writing? Or saying,
no,
yes, go ahead and publish it when your wife shows you something personal that she's about to publish?
Not really. I mean, that's the stuff that you make writing out of, whether you fictionalize it or whether you present it as nonfiction. That's the stuff that you make good writing out of, and the stuff that you know for sure is working, is going to connect, is going to make somebody want to keep reading it, is the stuff that makes you feel uncomfortable as you're writing it. Always. And that's the ultimate sign to me that I'm onto something is if I'm squirming a little bit as I'm writing about it, if it's making me feel uncomfortable, if I feel like I'm verging on things that make me nervous.
Give me an example of something that made you squirm that you wrote.
Well, they tell a story. I tell a story in this book about a woman who was a friend of my mother's who I had sex with when I was 15 years old. And that's a story, until I wrote it down, that was a story that I had told very few people. Two, maybe, or three in my whole life. And it had been suggested to me that I might, I had never tried writing about, you know, my first sexual experience. I decided that my first sexual experience wasn't that interesting, but my second. There was a story there, and I knew it, and I had lived with it for all of these years without ever telling it in any really detailed way. So, you know, I started writing this piece, and I got that sense right away of like, wow, am I really going to do this? Am I really going to write about this? You know, partly not because it's really that it's shocking or controversial. It was almost just the fact that I had held on to it so tightly for so long that it felt strange to kind of open up that jar finally and let it out. But, you know, I, that was as soon as I had that sense of unease or hesitation or the feeling of like, maybe I should come up with something else, that was the moment I said to myself, keep going, because this is where stuff comes from.
Okay, the story about having sex with your mother's friend.
Mm-hmm.
So you felt, you know, that squirmy feeling as you as you wrote it.
But and right now, sitting here in my chair, I'm having it all over again as you're preparing to ask me the question.
I can understand that. but I guess I'm wondering...
I brought it up.
I guess I'm wondering what the value you see in it as a story is. I mean, we've established it makes you uncomfortable. It's something you'd held on to for a long time. It was kind of a secret except for a few people. But now that it's out there, now that you found the words to tell it, now that you've been able to make this event in your life into a story... what does it mean to you as a story?
I guess ultimately it says something to me. It helped, if that's the right word, create in part the template for sex in my life so that, you know, there was a difficulty there. You know, the first experience was sort of a much more typical kind of teenage first experience. The second experience was this brush with the adult world, a kind of premature brush with the adult world, with an adult life, you know. And I think it pushed me up against the seriousness and the actual kind of emotional power of sex
and complications
in a way that I wasn't, you know, I just hadn't ever. I was 15 years old. I mean, you know, it was Meatloaf's Paradise by the Dashboard Light was, you know, kind of what I thought the sum total of sex would be, you know, avoid getting the girl pregnant and enjoy yourself. So, you know, it was a strange thing to do at that age, and to suddenly be presented with a sense that there's like a lot of weight and power and sort of sadness even that kind of lurks in the sexual relationships between people. And you know, what my reaction to that was to kind of close that door and say, you know, I'm just not ready for that. Yeah, I can't handle that. I don't want to know that now. But it, you know, I think that did shift my perspective on the subject.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Thereafter.
I could see how that would definitely, you know, complicate things for you. Did your mother know before you wrote the book?
No, she didn't. She didn't know until, you know, she read the piece as it was published. And we had a relatively brief and sort of emotionally neutral exchange of information about the piece. You know, I satisfied her curiosity. In her kind of characteristic way, she shrugged it off, and you know, it didn't seem to. I don't know. I honestly don't know what she thought when she read it, or how she felt when she read it, and I didn't ask.
Michael Chabon speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with author and essayist Michael Chabon. His latest volume of collected essays, called Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son, is now out in paperback.
David Foster Wallace, the writer who was a friend of yours, committed suicide. And
yeah, I should say we weren't. I didn't know him very well. I mean, I wish he had been a friend of mine. I always kind of wanted to be his friend, but I only met him once.
Okay. And you know, your wife had you know, mentioned in her writing that she came close to suicide once. And so you think about that. You reflect on that in your book. And you write, the world, like our heads, was meant to be escaped from. They are prison, the world and head alike. And then you quote David Foster Wallace as saying, I guess a big part of serious fiction's purpose is to give the reader, who like all of us is sort of marooned in their own skull, to give her imaginative access to other selves. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really beautiful description mm-hmm. of both the human human condition and the why we respond so well to, you know, to books and movies and music too. But I'm thinking, like, when you're a writer, it's maybe more of being trapped in your skull than being released from it as you're in the process of writing.
Not when it's going well, no. I mean, when my writing's going well, when I'm writing, you know, work of fiction, when I'm writing a novel, I'm there, whatever I'm writing about, whoever's head I'm in, I'm not in my head anymore. I'm in the head of the character, or if it's sort of an omniscient third-person narrator, I'm in the head of the narrator, who's not me, who is this much more intelligent, precise, open-souled, open-hearted being than I am. And that in itself, just being a narrator is there's a sense of release in that. And then to imagine the world you're describing, the physical world, the place, the house, the buildings, whatever it might be, it's all so vivid in my imagination that, it's very much like the experience of getting lost as a reader in a book. I'm sort of having a double experience of both sort of almost being in the actual reality I'm trying to create, and then a millisecond afterwards reading about it. I think that's part of the reason I love doing it so much, is because it does provide me with that sense, that same sense of escape, and also connectedness, because you're writing to, you're always addressing someone, you're writing to a reader, you have an ideal reader, an imagined reader out there that is the person who will just understand all of your references and who will understand the emotions that you're trying to, bring forth, and who will appreciate your every joke, and, you know, who will see the care that went into crafting this three-part metaphor that takes place over five pages. And you know, you're creating, that's a part of the imaginative act itself, is to create that reader and address the work to that reader. And that, again, it gives you that same illusion of connection. That is, I think another thing that keeps me doing it, that made me want to do it in the first place.
Well, we've been talking about some pretty heavy things, so I thought we could end with a story that I found really, really entertaining and funny, and it has to do with your diaper bag.
Oh, yes. The
MRS, which is, what, for male purse?
Yeah, exactly. We're struggling to come up with anything we can say that's not actually the word purse.
Yes, or pocketbook.
Yeah, oh, pocketbook, that's a good one. I haven't thought of that in a long time.
Yeah, so, as you point out, a lot of men feel like everything that they have to carry, and that's a lot, the wallet and all the mm-hmm. other stuff, has to be in pockets.
Yes.
And so you had these overstuffed pockets until you started carrying the diaper bag, and then what?
And then, I just, out of convenience, I started putting more things into the diaper bag. I always had this diaper bag with me. And I struggled with the diaper bag, too. It took me a while to find the right diaper bag that wasn't, too girly, that wasn't too babyish. So I found this sort of functional black vinyl or some kind of synthetic material bite diaper bag, and little by little, I'm carrying the New York Review of Books around under my arm. Why don't I just stick it in the diaper bag, and then I might as well put my keys in the diaper bag too. And then next thing and this is the big step. This is when you're really cutting the tether, is when you put your wallet in the diaper bag. Because taking your wallet, if you're a guy, taking your wallet out of your pocket and putting it anywhere else, whether it's your hip pocket or your vest pocket or your jacket or wherever you keep it, to put it into a bag and not have it on your body. Your wallet is you when you're a man, and to then just take it off your body and put it in a bag was a scary moment, but I did it. And you know, because having kids is basically an endless series of breaking you down and getting you to do all the things you never, you know, you thought your dignity would preserve you from ever having to do. And once I didn't need a diaper bag anymore, I didn't want to put all that stuff back in my pockets. It's stupid to carry stuff around in your pants pocket. It hurts. So, you know, I just got over it. And now, yes, I mean, I call it a purse now because my kids, that's what they called it, your purse. Daddy, you forgot your purse. So that's how I refer to it now, and it's sitting right here on the floor.
Michael Chabon, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for coming
back. Oh, thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it, too. Thank you.
Michael Chabon speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. His collection of essays, Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son, is now out in paperback. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. From Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Psychologist Dan Gottlieb wanted to share with his autistic grandson the lessons he learned from being a quadriplegic, so he wrote the popular book Letters to Sam. He's just written a follow-up. Coming up, we hear from Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Also, David Edelstein reviews two new documentaries, The Lottery and Restrepo. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. For decades, psychologist Dan Gottlieb has used various media to make intimate conversations public. He encourages people to eavesdrop and perhaps gain solace or insight as a result. After a car accident left him a quadriplegic, Gottlieb opened a private practice and for 25 years has served as host of a popular call-in radio show named Voices in the Family. It's broadcast on WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Dan Gottlieb was in his mid-50s and had been a quadriplegic for more than 20 years when his grandson Sam was diagnosed with autism. Dan wrote a series of letters to Sam describing his own experiences of being different. Those letters were collected in a 2006 book called Letters to Sam, and Dan Gottlieb has just published a sequel. It's called The Wisdom of Sam, and details the lessons Dan says he has learned from his grandson, who just turned 10. Terry Gross spoke with Dan Gottlieb in 2006 when the earlier book, Letters to Sam, was released, and when Sam, at the time, was just about to turn 6 years old.
Why did you want to write a book of letters to your grandson?
When he was born, I was a 56-year-old quadriplegic. I had been a quadriplegic for 20 years. I know my life expectancy is shortened. I live as Sartre said we should live, with death on my shoulder. I knew that anything could take me out, and I could feel that my body was beginning to fatigue. I wanted to share with Sam what I've learned, both as a psychologist and a quadriplegic, because I did not believe I would be in the world that he would see. And I wanted him to know who I was, how I saw the world. This is something most of us don't get from our grandparents. I wanted him to have that. And then when I learned that he had autism, it became more urgent. I felt I had more to tell him about being different. And the book has turned into two things: a book of love letters for my grandson, but in a way, it's a prayer for the world. The prayer is that the world becomes softer, more gentle, more loving, that the world Sam grows up in is safer than the world you and I are living in today.
I know that the car accident that left you paralyzed nearly killed you. So that forced you to change your life. You've had a few close calls with death in the past few years. Did those close calls almost allow you to change your life? You know, allow you to make changes that you actually wanted to make and felt that you couldn't?
Yes. Yes. What a great question. The vision I have about my accident is that when my neck broke, my soul began to breathe. I became the person I always dreamt I could be and never would have been if I didn't break my neck. And with each time I faced death, I became more of who I am and less worried about what others might think of me. This last time was 2 years ago. I've cut my practice back. I don't work quite as hard. That's a lie. I work just as hard. I don't work quite as hard on things that pay, but I work just as hard. But I spend more time with things I love. I am involved with the Boys and Girls Club. I'm involved in more volunteer activities.
Tell me how you think you became the person who you wanted to be and you thought you should be only after you broke your neck.
My genetic loading would have me being more depressed more of the time. My parents were both mild to moderately depressed their whole lives. The good news about quadriplegia is because I felt alienated as a child, I lived my whole life up until 33 thinking that if I made enough money, I'd be okay. If I was successful as a psychologist, if I was stronger. And when I broke my neck, I lost all hope. And that was a gift. I lost hope that I would ever walk again. I lost hope that I would ever be one of the kids again. My only choice was if I was going to live, I would live as me, not as the person I wanted to be ideally. It was liberating and terrifying.
I mean, did you feel that there were certain pressures that you or other people had put on yourself to become somebody who you weren't particularly?
We're all like that.
No. Not me ever.
Most people I know spend their lives trying to be the person they think they should be and never get to discover who they are. And that's the gift, one of the gifts, the fact that I can't run away from my demons, literally. I have to sit with them. the person I wanted to be. I had always dreamed of being a visionary, of being a peacemaker. But I had to be a psychologist. I had to be a father. I had to be the kind of man I thought I was supposed to be. And when I broke my neck, that was gone. I had to be the kind of man I was.
How did the accident happen in which you broke your neck?
I was traveling on the Pennsylvania Turnpike westbound. There was an 18-wheeler traveling eastbound. He lost his whole wheel, not his tire, but his whole wheel. It bounced across the turnpike and crushed my car. Thank God I was alone in the car, because whoever else would have been there would have been dead. And I'm also lucky that there was a car right across the street, and in that car, who watched the accident, there was an RN.
No.
So she ran across. As soon as she saw me, she knew I was a quadriplegic, and she knew not to take me out of the car. Me, being the person I am, when the ambulance came, I said, call everybody I know to come here right away. I knew I needed a support system.
Did they come?
Boy, did they come. I was in Ephrata, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour from Philadelphia. And they came. They came in droves. And they still do. I am sometimes embarrassed by my wealth.
I imagine that you don't remember the moment of impact.
No.
Is that a good thing, that you don't remember that?
I think it is. The last thing I remember is a big black thing in the sky. And that's the last thing I remember. I think, though, all of us, if we can use that metaphorically, all of us have been hit by a big black thing coming out of the sky. You know, it's a lump. It's a doctor saying, I think it's malignant. It's a spouse saying, I don't want to be in this marriage anymore. I'm no different than anybody else in that regard.
Were you certain that you wanted to live while you were in the hospital?
No.
Dealing with the news?
No, not at all. Not at all. I was surrounded with people who loved me. I was surrounded with people who told me I had value, and still I wanted to die. I was taken to intensive care one night, and there I lay in bed in a halo vest, which is a grotesque apparatus with where your head is bolted by metal bolts in order to immobilize your neck. I'm laying there with IVs, with catheters, looking at the ceiling, wishing I could go to sleep and not wake up. A nurse came up to my bedside one night. She said, you're a psychologist, aren't you? And I said, yes. She said, not knowing I was suicidal, she said, does everybody feel suicidal at some point in their lives? And I said, well, it's not unusual, but if you want to talk, come back after your shift. She pulls a chair up, 11 o'clock that night. We talk for an hour. Of course, it was her. She tells me about her life. I refer to a therapist. She leaves. I close my eyes, and I say to myself, I can live with this. That woman saved my life because she asked something of me. All these people told me I had value, but it had no meaning. She showed me that I had value by asking something of me, by allowing herself to be vulnerable with me and asking my help.
And you continued to be a therapist. You started your own practice. You didn't have your own practice before the accident, right?
It was a very small one, but I started my practice right after the accident.
Dan Gottlieb speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 conversation with psychologist and radio host Dan Gottlieb. They're discussing Letters to Sam, a collection of letters Dan wrote to his autistic grandson, discussing his own feelings of being different. Gottlieb was in his mid-30s when a car accident left him a quadriplegic.
When you returned to therapy after the accident, were you resentful of some of your clients and thinking, like, you think you have big problems? You can walk.
I had that experience once. I was working with a man who was being treated for alcoholism, and in a drunken stupor, he killed a girl. He got off for some reason. I'm watching him in the chair rationalize this, wiggling his foot as he did it. And I'm thinking, I would like to kill this man for what he's done. That was the only time I felt it. I did have those emotions. When I was in the hospital, I was looking out my window at a street, at a man living on a vent, and I was envious of him. I thought, at least he can get up and walk off the vent, and I can't. And now, I'm envious of no one. No one. I don't have that emotion of envy.
Do you think that your patients are ever almost reluctant to tell you their problems, thinking like, oh, this will sound kind of trite because, you know, he can't walk and I'm complaining about that my mother hollered at me yesterday?
Yes, they do say that. I mean, my position on that is suffering. Quadriplegia is a fact. A history of child abuse is a fact. But suffering is suffering. I mean, if you're not able to sleep at night, you're suffering. I'm not suffering with quadriplegia. There was a man in my office a couple of years ago, extremely obese man with two artificial knees, sitting in a chair that was probably too low for him. So it's the end of the session, and he struggles to get out of the chair. And he's working hard. I feel badly. And I'm watching, and he knows I'm watching. And he gets up, and he takes a deep breath. And he says, you know, Dan, he says, as hard as it was for me to get out of the chair, he says, I look at you and I think, thank God I can get out of the chair. Maybe I shouldn't say it, but that's what goes through my mind. And I said, you know, I got to be honest with you. I said, I look at you and how hard you struggle to get out of the chair, and I think, thank God I don't have to go through that crap when I get older.
What was his reaction?
We both laughed. You know, it's all a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of how you look at it. You know, my dad used to tell a wonderful story, if I may.
Please.
As he got older, he used to say, I'm ready to leave this veil of tears. And I said to him, Dad, is your life that bad that you're really ready to go? He said, some days. I said, well, tell me about those days. He said, well, I get to thinking, my wife is gone, my daughter's gone, my sister had died 5 years earlier, and here's my son struggling through life every day in a wheelchair. He said, those days I'm ready to go. I said, but Dad, those things are true every day. Tell me about the days you're not ready to go. He says, I'm not thinking about those things. It's all perspective. It's all where your mind lands is how you read your life and how you experience it.
Well, he's ready to kill himself because you're in a chair, and of course, you're not feeling that way about it when he's saying this.
Well, the truth of the matter is...
You were?
No, not at all. The truth of the matter is, I would much rather be a quadriplegic than be a parent of a quadriplegic.
Really, why?
Oh, the helplessness he felt watching me every day in his life. The powerlessness, the stories he told himself about my suffering. I mean, I can't imagine. I've watched both my daughters be ill, and I suffered more than they did. I watched my wife when I went back to work as a quadriplegic. I was hospitalized for a year, and I went back to the clinic I worked in, and it was very difficult for me, and the staff was unkind to me. And her rage and helplessness at them. Meanwhile, I had the ability to work it out with them. I was in there. I worked it out with them. I was fine. She could never forgive them because the person she loved was suffering, and there was nothing she could do about about it. You know, the famous psychoanalyst Sheldon Kopp said, the most difficult part of love is dealing with your helplessness in the face of a loved one suffering. And that's what it means to be a parent of a quadriplegic.
You mentioned earlier that you're part of the first generation of people with quadriplegia who have lived into their late 50s, that, you know, medical science has gotten to that point. And so, and you've nearly died a couple of times. You've come really close. At the same time, you have people who have been able-bodied, weren't in accidents, and who have died. Your ex-wife died. Your sister had a brain tumor and died. I'm just kind of thinking of, like, the relative length of life that the people who had seemed healthy have already left.
I don't know how to respond, Terry. You know, Franklin Abbott, a sociologist, said that we couldn't have life without death. We couldn't understand it. The closer I come to death, and I feel I come closer every day, feel it, know it, touch it, the more that happens, the more precious I feel daytime is, nighttime, colors, knowing you, being here, writing this book, the more grateful I feel for what I have. The imminence of death just makes life more alive. I don't know, Terry, if we could do it without smelling death.
You've done a radio show at WHYY in Philadelphia for many years. How many years is that? 20?
20.
So does therapy help you as an interviewer? You know, do the skills of a therapist help you with the skills as an interviewer on your radio show?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much. They started off helping me a lot, and then I had to hone them because I could sit for 50 minutes easily with one patient and be very interested, but that doesn't make for good radio, the kinds of questions I've asked. My years on the radio has helped me hone my question and get to the heart of things very quickly.
So radio's helped you as a therapist?
Radio's helped me as a therapist a great deal. I'm much more efficient as a therapist. One thing I learned, a patient came to me years ago, and she said, I feel like my soul is a prism, and everybody I know only sees one color, and nobody sees the whole prism. And I thought, that's the way to be a good therapist. It's the way to be a good parent, a good spouse, a good lover, is to see the prism of somebody else's soul. And that's what I do as a therapist, as a radio interviewer, even as a friend. I work very hard to see the prism of somebody else's soul. And that's what my questions are geared towards. Help me see the prism of your soul.
It sounds like you have a really good perspective on life and death and on your physical limitations. With quadriplegia, and you said before there's no one that you envy. Like you've put that kind of envy behind you. Are there times though where it just gets to you, and you don't have such a clear view? You don't have such a good handle on the world and your emotions and all of that.
Oh, often, I don't feel envy. That doesn't mean I don't suffer. I remember a couple of years ago, I was driving in my van and I saw somebody jogging on the drive one spring day. And I just burst into tears. I had to pull over to the side of the road. I was crying so hard. I suffer greatly. I suffer that my bladder is failing. I suffer. I feel great pain during the day. But I say to people, my body is broken, my mind is neurotic, and my soul is at peace. And that is really true. It's really true. I suffer with my body. On occasion, I suffer with my mind, and my soul really is at peace today. And I pray it's at peace tomorrow, too. And I pray it's at peace when I'm in my deathbed.
Well, Dan Gottlieb, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It was delightful.
psychologist Dan Gottlieb speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. His book, Letters to Sam, in which he wrote advice and observations to his young autistic grandson, has been followed by a new sequel, Wisdom from Sam, published in April by Hay House. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein on two new documentaries. This is Fresh Air. This week, our film critic, David Edelstein, reviews two new documentaries. Restrepo is set in Afghanistan and is co-directed by journalist Sebastian Younger, who wrote The Perfect Storm, and war photographer Tim Hetherington. Madeline Sackler's The Lottery centers on high-testing charter schools in Harlem and the drawing that determines who gets in.
Maybe it's a reaction to empty summer escapist movies like The A-Team and Night and Day, but I've had a sudden urge to escape not from, but to reality. If you share that impulse, seek out a pair of unusually urgent documentaries, Restrepo and The Lottery. The grueling Restrepo takes its name from a mountainside outpost in the Korangal region of Afghanistan, where in 2007, Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger got themselves embedded with the 2nd Platoon. That outpost, or OP, takes its name from a charismatic company medic whom we see in video that opens the film. He's on a train with his buddies, they've had a lot to drink, and he's whooping, "We're going to war." Not long after that, Juan Restrepo took two bullets in the neck. OP Restrepo is the site of constant fighting between U.S. forces and the Taliban. The captain, Dan Kearney, describes its impact on the enemy as men show off their artillery.
When the boys built that base, Taliban or the AAF forces in the valley, they were completely in shock. It was like a middle finger sticking out. And they realized once they could not knock off OP Restrepo, we had the upper hand. They started becoming afraid.
Get some, Tobin! Woo!
Hey, hit the bottom right. Hit the bottom right of the village.
Get this!
Those weapons send out balls of fire in long, deadly arcs. But no foreign force is likely to gain the upper hand in this place. The landscape from a distance seems barely marked, the bombs absorbed by the same trees and terraced hills that hide the Taliban, whom we never actually see. We share the perspective of the men who wait for the inevitable assaults, their most trivial exchanges seeming, in this context, momentous. Hetherington and Younger keep filming during the frequent firefights, and you can feel their fight-or-flight instincts in the way their cameras jerk and swerve and point at the ground or the sky. What carnage we see is after the fact, when men gather around the bodies of fellow soldiers, in one case weeping in incomprehension. The directors have said they meant for Restrepo to be objective and apolitical, its focus on the bonds among the men, and what Younger calls in his brilliant new book War, which expands on what we see in the film, the zen of not effing up. What should have been the most hopeful scene in the movie might be the grimmest. Kearney asks Korangali elders, some with beards dyed orange to show they've been to Mecca, to join with him, promising money and new projects, and they stare at him, expressionless. Then 7 civilians in the same village are killed in a U.S. operation, and the few hearts and minds that were in play are forever lost. Unlike Hetherington and Younger, director Madeline Sackler sets out to incite and enrage. The lottery is a devastating piece of propaganda. It unfolds on the home front in New York City, where 3,000 small children apply for 475 slots in charter schools in and around Harlem. These autonomous public schools have been stunningly successful in turning out literate, motivated kids in neighborhoods known for high double-digit dropout rates. But as Sackler profiles four families with children in the running, you get a sinking feeling there are nowhere near enough happy endings to go around. These kids are heartbreakingly open and engaged and eager. But the true focus of the lottery is the battle between Harlem Success Charter Schools president Eva Moskowitz and a ferocious coalition of charter school opponents. How, given the high test scores, could the movement create such a violent schism in the community? Charter schools are non-union, and as Sackler frames the fight, it's the teachers' unions that are pulling the strings, using surrogate organizations like ACORN, as it was then called, and Democratic politicians whose campaign chests they fatten. As the lottery presents them, these politicians and community activists come off as working to keep in place a system that is, objectively, a disaster. It makes you wonder whether the kids who lose the lottery are the victims of chance or of forces more frustratingly human.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Linda Greenhouse, author of Before Roe v. Wade, about what led to the landmark Supreme Court decision on abortion. She says public discourse didn't begin with feminists and the emerging right-to-life groups.
It was an issue that was put forward by the public health community.
Join us.